Blog Talk Radio.
It's breaking news time on the Eastern Airlines radio show. Dorothy?
Breaking news number one. Crisis averted. After glitch, American Airlines says your Christmas flight may be saved by Shibeli Herrera. It seems Christmas is not ruined yet. After a computer glitch that gave too many American Airlines pilots vacation time in December and put more than 15,000 holiday flights in jeopardy of cancellation, According to the estimates by the Allied Pilots Association, the airline is now close to a resolution. Out of 2,000 flights, 200,000 flights, America will operate in December. Only a few hundred currently don't have pilots, says American Airlines spokeswoman Alexis Aaron Coelho in an update Thursday after the malfunction was made public Wednesday. But the Allied Pilots Association, which represents 15,000 American Airlines pilots, refutes that number. The Fort Worth, Texas-based union said in a statement Thursday that it's able to view in real time the December flight crew announcements. However, as an update as of December 1, there is no need to charter a slave pulled by reindeer for your air travel to holiday destinations after all. American Airlines and its pilots have worked out a deal so our staff cockpits in the late December after a scheduling snafu threatened to cancel thousands of flights. American apparently did just that. After a meeting Friday between union leadership and American senior management, they reached an agreement in principle addressing our respective needs, and we have withdrawn our grievance, the Allied Pilots Association said in a statement. See more in newsletter online August 7th to December 17th.
Breaking news number two. Spirit Airlines launches 11 new routes, including a Fort Lauderdale-Seattle flight. By Ammon Reiser, South Florida Business Journal, November 29, 2017. Dying for more vacation travelers, Spirit Airlines Incorporated has launched new routes to tourism hotspots, including Fort Lauderdale, Tampa, Las Vegas, Montego Bay, Jamaica. The Miramar-based discount airline NASDAQ SABE on April 12 will start daily seasonal flights between the Fort Lauderdale Hollywood International Airport, FLL, and Seattle Tacoma International Airport, SCA. Spirit CEO Bob Fornaro said on an earnings call earlier this month that the airline will be adding more flights to vacation destinations to draw more dollars from leisure travelers. Quote, large carriers can't price the markets for the typical leisure customer. That's why the opportunity is in large markets rather than small markets, he said during the call.
Breaking news number three, pilot shortage hitting business aviation. This was by Russ Niles on the 19th of November. While regional airlines seem to be the hardest hit so far by the tightening supply of pilots, business aircraft operators are also feeling the pinch. As with regards to regionals, deep-targeted larger airlines are outbidding smaller operators for the pool of experienced jet pilots, and there is an inevitable result from that. Quote, it's really a buyer's market, and the buyer is the pillow, unquote. Dennis Taylor, a spokesman for the Airline Pilots Association, told Reuters, if you don't pay pilots the market rate, you're going to lose them. You can see more of this online August through December 2017. Sounds like Neil, Jim, George, Ken, you guys better come out of retirement. Chuck?
He would break the system. James Benoit, November 19, 2017. One of the most important conversations going on in Aviation Day has to do with the proposal to remove the Air Traffic Control Organization from the FAA and turn it into a privatized entity. Proponents claim that it would be free from the function from the bureaucracy and the petty budgetary pressures of the FAA and lead to a more efficient operation. They also claim it will result in a more rapid modernization of air traffic control systems. Opponents to the privatization proposal base most of their arguments on three points. First, they point out that the air traffic control's function is working quite well, and there's no reason to fix something that's not broke. Sounds reasonable. Second, They claim that moving to a privatized system would inevitably lead to a user's fee system dominated by the airlines, probably, which would penalize the general aviation sector. Third, they point out that the entity would have a monopoly control over the air traffic control system with minimum oversight by the government, a recipe for corruption and gross mismanagement. Now, we know that the government's not mismanaging. See more on newsletter outline August 7th.
Hello, Eastern family. It's great having you with us for our 344th broadcast tonight. We want to welcome and thank all of our listeners who call and to our broadcast to listen to our broadcast every Monday evening. We'd love to hear from your comments or have you share your memories by just picking up your telephone and calling in 213-816-1611, of course, at 7 p.m. when we go on air. It'd be fun listening to other callers that have memories of Eastern Airlines. Our thanks also to those who choose to listen by computer using the radio icon on our homepage at www.ealradioshow.com, or perhaps by using their computer and they signed in at a site of our provider. A provider of our radio show, of course, is Blog Talk Radio. And that's blogtalkradio.com/Captain Eddie. And that's abbreviated CAPTEDDIE. Should you too wish to talk on our live broadcast, just call in that number again. I'm going to repeat it, 213-816-1611. Your number will pop up on my producer's board, and just join in the conversation. Our lines are open for calls, and if you choose not to participate but just listen on your telephone, we ask you to please mute your phone, as our producer board does not have the capability of filtering our background noises. Now, let's get episode 344 in the air.
Justice is moving rapidly to intern all Japanese nationals. The city of New York has already ordered all Japanese nationals to remain off the streets. Wartime decrees are slated for emergency passage this week. This will mobilize the efforts of the whole American people. The Japanese property in the United States will be seized at once. The Japanese naval effort tonight is unsound, both naval and land. The Chinese today inform Washington that General Chiang Kai-shek will launch a 4-million-man counteroffensive. All Chinese route armies are intact, and with proper material, Chiang Kai-shek is prepared to support the Russian front. Russia has over 800,000 crack troops poised in the maritime provinces on the Pacific. Official Washington tonight regards Tokyo as authored by Berlin. An all-out effort by the Axis in Africa and Russia is a certainty. The Axis objective is to leave Great Britain and the United States entirely isolated by next spring. The importance of the Japanese attack is that war between the United States and Hitler is imminent. The national emergency is no longer a phrase. Persons who arouse suspicion by their conduct, speech, or deed are inviting microscopic examination, perhaps prison. Nothing matters anymore now except national security. New York. The leading isolationist newspaper of the United States, the New York Daily News, tonight says editorially that we all should stick by the president in this momentous hour. Chicago. The Chicago Tribune, the leading isolationist paper in the Middle West, has come out for, quotes, our country, right or wrong, end quotes. Governor Lehman of New York has sent out an alert order to all state guards and the police. President Roosevelt's Special Mediation Board has just awarded Lewis's United Mine Workers a closed shop in the captive coal mine. If you missed any of the news, this is to repeat that the Dutch East Indies and Costa Rica have declared war on Japan. The acting Japanese Consul General in Chicago said tonight that it is questionable how long Japan could continue at war with the United States. My country, he said, is not wealthy. The following is the opinion of a naval authority. The Japanese airplanes that attacked the Hawaiian Islands was probably a suicide force which did not expect to return to base, because the best fortified, best manned stronghold in the world is the Hawaiian Islands. Military and naval commanders there have been anticipating an attack like the one that occurred today. That's why the anti-aircraft guns went into action on the split second. There is little likelihood that another attack on these islands will be made successfully for some time to come. Do not look for the Japanese to engage our main battle fleet except as a last desperate resort. Behind the international scene, Mandalay. In the expected emergency, the Burma Road will be defended throughout its length by the RAF and whole squadrons of American volunteers. Reports of their ships and stations. Washington. Reports here state that the Japanese are producing 1,000 fighting planes a month. The Japs are also said to have more than 100 German Messerschmitts for protection in case of air raids. Ladies and gentlemen, 5 minutes ago, the Navy Department from Washington informed me that they are appealing to all men between the ages of 17 and 50 for enlistment in all branches of the service. I repeat, all branches of the service. Your services, Mr. America, are needed right now. Please apply to your nearest recruiting station for all particulars. Somewhere in Libya, a soldier fighting with the British in Libya named Patrick Hamilton doesn't know of his good fortune. He is the author of a new show on Broadway called Angel Street, which is New York's latest big hit. It is a study of psychopathic cruelty in which a husband tries to make his wife believe She has lost her mind. And that, ladies and gentlemen, winds up another Jurgen's Journal until next Sunday night at the very same time. Until then, and with lotions of love, I remain your New York correspondent, Walter Winchell, who reminds the historians that Japan has violated her oldest tradition. Harry Carey is honorable suicide. Good night.
Presenting the President of the United States.
Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate, of the House of Representatives, yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation and, at solicitation of Japan, still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific. Indeed, 1 hour after Japanese air squadrons had commenced bombing in the American island of Oahu, the Japanese ambassador to the United States and his colleague delivered to our Secretary of State a formal reply to a recent American message. And while this reply stated that it seemed useless to continue the existing diplomatic negotiations, it contained no threat or hint of war or of armed attack. It will be recorded that the distance of Hawaii from Japan makes it obvious that the attack was deliberately planned many days or even weeks ago. During the intervening time, the Japanese government has deliberately sought to deceive the United States by false statements and expressions of hope for continued peace. The attack yesterday on the Hawaiian Islands has caused severe damage to American naval and military forces. I regret to tell you that very many American lives have been lost. In addition, American ships have been reported torpedoed on the high seas between San Francisco and Honolulu. Yesterday, the Japanese government also launched an attack against Malaya. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Hong Kong. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Guam. Last night, Japanese forces attacked the Philippine Islands. Last night, the Japanese attacked Wake Island. And this morning, the Japanese attacked Midway Island. Japan has therefore undertaken a surprise offensive extending throughout the Pacific area. The fact of yesterday and today speak for themselves. The people of the United States have already formed their opinions and well understand the implications to the very life and safety of our nation. As Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, I have directed that all measures be taken for our defense, but always will our whole nation remember the character of the onslaught against us. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory. I believe that I interpret the will of the Congress and of the people when I assert that we will not only defend ourselves to the uttermost, but will make it very certain that this form of treachery shall never again endanger us. Hostilities exist. There is no blinking at the fact that our people, our territory, and our interests are in grave danger. With confidence in our armed forces, with the unbounding determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph, so help us God. I ask that the Congress declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
Congress, with overwhelming acclaim, then voted the declaration of a state of war, and the President signed it 3 hours after this historic scene.
And now, listeners, your host will be reading excerpts from Pearl Harbor, 76 years later speech, 2016, from the American Legion Media and Communications Division, which was in November of 2016. 75 years later, most of the witnesses are no longer with us, but the legacy of the men and women who defended Pearl Harbor on the day of infamy will always remain. It was a day that defined America and changed the world. Service, sacrifice, and valor were demonstrated by American heroes at unprecedented levels and foreshadowed the trials, toughness, and grit that epitomized the greatest generation during the Second World War. Those who did not perish during the attack were not just veterans of battle. They were survivors of an unprovoked and unexpected massive killing spree. Men like Sterling Kale, who would later serve his country in Korea and Vietnam after surviving numerous battles in the Pacific War. A 20-year-old pharmacist mate assigned to the U.S. Naval Hospital, Pearl Harbor, on December 7, 1941, Kale attended last year's American Legion Department of Hawaii observances of the attack.
Nearly three quarters of a century later, he still recalls the
charred Bonnie, the ash. He recovered and was put in charge of a burial party tasked with removing the bodies from the USS Arizona. All black ash. One corpse decapitated, he said. There were types of memories that continue to haunt even a battle-hardened veteran that would later serve as a Navy corpsman with the 1st Marine Division at Guadalcanal. Following survivor Bob Adibati founded the Pearl Harbor Survivor Association chapter in Sacramento, California. But it's December 6, 1941, that Adibati often remembered that he recalled the date of infamy. There was a battle of band contest in Chinatown that night, he said, that in 2015. All the ships had different bands. He spoke to several sailors in the USS Arizona. Tragically, 8 hours later, every sailor in the band was dead. Dorothy?
Mr. Adibati. It was the beginning for the 19-year-old single man on the USS Solis. He would later lose his leg after his ship was torpedoed at the Admiralty Islands. He would raise a family, retire from the U.S. Postal Service, and survive until January 15th of this year, when at the age of 93, he would reunite with his fallen but never forgotten shipmates. So many are gone now, the more than 2,400 men, women, and children who died the day of the attack will be joined by thousands of others in the 7.5 decades since. As those able to provide firsthand accounts leave the ranks of the living, it is up to us to keep their legacies alive. 15 medals of honor were awarded as a result of the attack, 51 Navy crosses, 53 Silver Stars. Thousands of other acts of heroism were not recognized with medals because documenting the acts was not the priority. Saving others and fighting another day in order to defeat those who brought the war became job number one. 60 years after the attack on Pearl Harbor, America was caught off guard once again. September 11, 2001, was another date that will live in infamy to a new generation of Americans. It would mark the beginning of another painful war, one against global terrorists that continues to this day. And while military members of the greatest generation took incredible risks to save their comrades, we saw similar courage from police officers, firefighters, and first responders who entered burning buildings when logic and instinct would compel lesser people to move in that other direction. Many of the 9/11 heroes were veterans. Nearly all were taught about the Pearl Harbor attack in history class. There was something very American about their response.
Just as Pearl Harbor heroes were likely inspired by the doughboys of World War I, the valor that we continue to witness among today's military is at least partially the result of young men and women who want to live up to the legacies of those who preceded them. Fearlessness is also the legacy of Pearl Harbor survivor Jack Evans, a 17-year-old lookout on the USS Tennessee. During the attack, his memory of that day was, quote, "everything was on fire, death and destruction everywhere," unquote. Yet the California native recently told the American Legion magazine that he and his crewmates were not frightened. "Most people just set their jawline," he said, "and went about doing their jobs. There were very few who went into hysterics or anything of that nature. I really wasn't scared. It was so frustrating to be in a situation where there is so little you can do. You want to fight those guys, and there's no way to do it," unquote. Thankfully, they found a way. They would continue to fight in a war that would claim 291,557 U.S. lives on the battlefield. More than 670,000 Americans were wounded.
American Legion National Commander Charles Smith often encourages Legionnaires to carry the legacy forward. He refers to the great accomplishments of previous generations of Legionnaires while also asking veterans to begin new legacies that will benefit the next generation. The incredible resilience and valor of the men and women at Pearl Harbor is a legacy that has benefited not just the American Legion, but the entire free world. Well, Pearl Harbor is also the story of a remarkable comeback. The Japanese thought they would strike an early and crippling blow to America's naval and air capabilities. They failed. Despite the advantage of surprise exploited by the Japanese planes and submarines, the feisty Americans at Pearl Harbor still destroyed 29 enemy aircraft, damaged 29 others, and sunk or beached 5 mini-subs. 6 American battleships that were sunk or damaged during the attack were restored, refloated, and returned to service. Survivors who were physically able to continue their service fought on for the duration of the war until wounded or killed. For the United States, Pearl Harbor marked the beginning of a war. For Japan, it was the beginning of the end. And for those heroes of 75 years ago, we shall always be grateful. God bless you. God bless our World War II veterans. And God bless America. Bill?
Most of the hosts and listeners were too young to have remembered hearing FDR's Declaration of War speech, but some of us followed the news from overseas on the radio, from news broadcasters like Walter Winchell, Edward R. Murrow, Ernie Pyle, Douglas Edwards, Charles Collingwood, Walter Cronkite, H.V. Kaltenborn, Gabriel Heater, and many others. Here's what was happening with the major news broadcasters on December 7th. On a lazy Sunday morning at the Pearl Harbor Naval Base, the day was just beginning. It was approaching 8 in the morning. Meanwhile, in New York City, it was already afternoon. The East Coast was listening to a football game between the New York Giants and the Brooklyn Dodgers, which had an approximate 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time kickoff. At approximately 2:26, WOR, possibly Mutual, broke into the game with a surprise bulletin about an attack on the naval base at Pearl Harbor. The NBC Red Network, broadcasting Sammy Kaye's Sunday Serenade with Sammy and his orchestra, Tommy Ryan, Alan Foster, and the 3 cadets. The day's broadcast was just about finished. The next up was the rather bland University of Chicago Roundtable. The topic was Canada, a neighbor at war. Canada, part of the British Empire, had declared war on Germany soon after England. While we supplied material to the British, Canada was supplying an even more precious commodity, men. Just as the NBC network program changeover was to take place, it upcut the start of the roundtable with its first bulletin on the Pearl Harbor bombing at 2:59 and 50 seconds p.m., read by NBC News writer Robert Eisenbach. At the same time, on the Blue Network, NBC interrupted its Great Plays broadcast of the Inspector General with the same bulletin.
Meanwhile, over at CPS, where the only regularly scheduled news broadcast on Sundays was about to begin, things were in disarray as the United Press Wire news flash flowed in about the bombing. About 2:30 p.m. was the World Today. Now, normally this program would have gone onto the air to report current world events. It was about a 17-second lead-in time to the announcer summarizing what would be heard on the program, followed by a John Daly beginning his report. Now, this day, information was coming into the newsroom about the United Press bulletin that the Japanese were bombing Pearl Harbor. The decision was made to break in immediately when the bulletin read by the announcer, John Daly, about the attack. Now, of course, this created a problem for CBS West Coast, which normally used that 17-second lead-in time to plug their own sponsor, Golden Eagle Gasoline. Not all the bulletin seems available in audio format. Well, in addition to what you hear on the daily audio, former CBS writer Edward Bliss wrote a bulletin that also contained this. Quote, "The news just came in after two Japanese envoys in Washington made the appointment to call at the State Department and follows reports from the Far East that Japan was ready to launch an attack on Thailand." Jim?
More likely. Thank you. More likely, East Coast heard no opening announcement, the World Today program, but rather the roughly 12-second bulletin announcement. Then it switched to Washington to hear Albert Warner. This whole thing would create about a 29-minute program with fits, considering the bulletin came in over CBS at 2:30 p.m. West Coast listeners heard the normal opening, as in the bulletin clip, but then realizing that the normal opening to the program in New York was not going on, they frantically tried to switch to New York. At this time, switching circuits could take about 5 to 10 seconds, and so after the opening, West Coast listeners heard silence as the switching took place, and Albert Warner came on immediately. CBS continued with additional commentary on the impact of this event by Albert Warner below, but NBC continued its regular programming. That CBS's regular program was news-related offered it a better opportunity to give broader coverage. Ken?
Good. Thank you. Now, 2:38 and 20 seconds p.m., NBC Red offered another bulletin that Manila was being bombed, which later would prove to be false. Now, this was followed by at 2:52 p.m. by the University of Chicago Roundtable moderator mentioning that Burma was being bombed. At CBS at 2:33 p.m., Washington, D.C.-based newsman Albert Warner speculated on what possible steps FDR would take, given that the Japanese envoys were meeting with Secretary of State Cordell Hull as the bombing was taking place. 2:39, Warner interrupts his own analysis with a bulletin that the Japanese were bombing Manila.
Probably surprising today, but not then, NBC went back to the regularly scheduled broadcasting until the top of the hour at 3 p.m. Radio was driven mostly by commercial sponsors. To interrupt a sponsored program required the permission of the sponsor executive. While there were several interruptions during the University of Chicago roundtable on the Red Network, there was only one on the Blue Network during its regularly scheduled Great Plays. CBS, on the other hand, was in the midst of a news program and could continue without problems broadcasting breaking news. In London, CBS broadcaster Robert Trout spoke briefly about what impact the news would probably have on Britain, which was not yet aware of the news. Due to the Austrian crisis a couple of years before, all of the U.S. radio news organizations began beefing up their overseas coverage, especially CBS. They were ready to report from overseas. Then during an analysis by Elmer Davis, John Daly cut in with another bulletin that the attack was still going on. CBS was able to get a telephone line from New York through to Ford Wilkins, their stringer in Manila, who began to report that the Philippines were now under attack. But due to sudden censorship by the U.S. government, he was cut off at 2:49 p.m.
At 3 p.m., CBS began broadcast of its regularly scheduled New York Philharmonic Orchestra program. NBC Red returned at 3:15 p.m. with comments from H.B. Kaltenborn. Except for bulletin interruptions, regular programming continued into the evening as the fact of a country soon to be at war began to dawn on America. As events developed, government control of the airwaves began to unfold. On the NBC Red Network, at 4:06 42nd p.m., a report from the roof of KGU in Honolulu was suddenly cut off by a telephone operator seizing the line for an emergency at 4:09:15 p.m. Later in the evening, Hawaiian time, KGU broadcast the brief summary of events and the eyewitness reports. The coming of America's involvement in the Second World War also brought the increasing development and rise of broadcast journalism. Much of that credit goes to Edward R. Murrow and the CBS News team. Also, there were equally innovators at NBC and the Mutual Broadcasting System. But on this day, we could only witness the first pangs of its birth.
Well, that's the way it was on December 7th, 1941. We would like to hear from our listeners and hosts their thoughts about December 7th or add a World War II story to the program. Neil, I see your hand raised. Would you like to tell us your personal story of what you remembered about this day of infamy?
You know, going all the way back to 1941, I can't go all the way back, but I do have just little flashes of memory about 1941 and FDR's speech, which we heard tonight, and it was a powerful speech. Of course, we all listened on radio. There was no TV during that time, and I did listen to, and perhaps it was the memory that was later on that left the impression of December 7th, 1941. And some of the stories dating back when I was a youth, in my youth, I guess I was about 8 or 9 years old. I remember Gabriel Heater, one of the leading announcers of that day, and he lived in Miami when he retired to Miami Beach. My mother had a hair salon business, beauty shop, we call them back in those days. And during high school, she had me hauling her very important VIP customers to her hair salon to have their hair set and dyed and permanent waves and manicures and pedicures and so forth. And one of her customers was Mrs. Gabriel Heater. And I had the pleasure of picking her up on her Miami Beach home. At her Miami Beach home, and also one day taking her home, there was the man himself, Gabriel Heater. Now, depending upon the network, they had their own stars just like we have today. But Walter Winchell, which we heard earlier in our broadcast, seemed to be the one that, and Edward R. Morrow was the one that everyone kind of looked up to, and those were the stars, but they were the important folks. But I have many memories, Jim, back during that time of the history of this this very horrific event. Of course, another one followed many, many years later, which Dorothy talked about, and that was the World Trade Center. Jim, I think you have one you were telling me about, and then we're going to open up all the microphones and hear some stories from others that might want to recall the day back in 1941. Jim, you have a story?
Yeah, well, Neil, I remember, I don't remember Pearl Harbor, I really don't, but I remember many, like, snapshots that I can go back and remember this happened, this happened, this happened. And I know you're talking about one you and I discussed. But I want to mention that I remember my grandfather sitting with his ear to the radio in the red and blue, and I never understood the red and blue then. I certainly don't know it now. But I can remember listening to the news, and I'll guarantee you every person in Lexington, Mississippi had their ear to the radio listening to the news about the war. But the biggest one I remember, other than Edward R. Murrah, was H.B. Kaltenborn. I just thought that was a fantastic name, H.B. Kaltenborn, coming on telling us what was going on in the world. I remember it well. But I remember one of my biggest memories, it's still not the one you were talking about, is, and I may have mentioned this on an earlier podcast, for some reason I think I remember it. But my Aunt Pat, who was like an older sister, we lived down in the country from Lake Mississippi, and we hooked up the mule, old black boy, and went down to pump water to wash clothes. And while we were down there, I remember us talking about the fact that we had just heard on the radio that FDR died the day before. And that's one of my biggest memories of World War II, was down there pumping water for washing clothes, and talking about how probably Hitler just thought that was the greatest news in the world, that FDR died. I remember that. And it turned out, reading historical items over the years, in fact, Hitler did think that was a sign from God or something. I don't know. that Germany was going to turn around and win the war, which, of course, meant nothing. They had no – that did not happen. But I will mention that one story that I told you about, my memory. And once again, this is like a 7 or 8 year old boy sitting in Lexington, Mississippi, or out in the country. One day on the porch, we could see the road down there, the gravel road that went into town. And I heard the most god-awful noise coming. And it sounded like nothing I'd ever heard before. I'd heard the road grader, I'd heard school buses, I'd heard everything under the sun, but I never heard anything like this. And I'm sitting there wondering what is coming down the road. And what it was a car going into town 6 miles away, riding on its rims. No tires, just a rim. The tires and the tubes were not there. And the reason he was doing that was probably he figured he had one last chance to get into town because nobody had any tires. You couldn't buy tires. You couldn't buy any tubes. You couldn't buy anything made of rubber. It was all going to the war effort. And there was this car came by riding on the rims for 6 miles to get into town. And I imagine once he got there, that was the end of his trip, I believe so. I have some other stories, but I'll let some other people talk.
One before we all the microphones, by the way, are open, and I want to hear from our host and our listeners. I'm sure you all have stories. We sat in the cockpit with some of the greatest generation, Jim, George, Ken, and we shared, or we didn't share, but we listened to those captains that we were flying with share their memories of World War II, because we flew with those guys, and many pilots that flew the war, World War II, and one that particularly I think about now is Jack Tack, Captain Jack Tack, based in Atlanta. And a very modest guy, didn't talk very much in the cockpit, but you had to really ask him questions to get anything out of him. And I flew a trip with him one day, and I was amazed that he was an ace, a World War II ace. And he was shot down in the Pacific Ocean and was on a raft until he was rescued. And it was remarkable people like Jack Tack and so many others that flew for Eastern Airlines that just meant so much to me as I was just a student learning to fly almost. I knew how to fly, but here I was sitting with these giants of aviation, these remarkable men, brave men that fought in World War II. That's my thoughts right now. So I'm going to open the microphones. Anyone have any comments, please?
Neil?
Yes, sir.
Did we have a pilot that flew for Eastern that was the first officer or the co-pilot on the Enola Gay that dropped the first bomb?
Yes, we did. Jim, you and I both were editors of REPA magazine. I think I reported it in one of the magazines that I published, and I think you probably have some memory of that, don't you?
Yes, I
Jim
do.
Holder?
And actually, he was the co-pilot on the second bomb at Nagasaki. He was the co-pilot on Nagasaki, not Hiroshima. And he was ended up being an Eastern pilot, and his name escapes me right now.
Hey,
I think he was on the weather ship for the, they had about 3 B-29s that did the Hiroshima attack, maybe 4. And he was the co-pilot on one of them. But he later was, in fact, the co-pilot on the one that dropped the bomb over Nagasaki.
Okay. Another comment I just heard.
Yeah, Neil, I don't know if people are aware of it or not, but at Eastern, at least based in New York, we had a captain here who flew for the Luftwaffe in World War II, Helmut Hetz. And
absolutely.
In fact, he was a Czech pilot. And but he always, I always get a kick out of him when we flew together. He would say, yeah, but I always flew on the Eastern Front. That was his favorite line. But, I mean, it was amazing because there were people – flying there, like Al Bevelack, he flew the Hump over there in the C-46 during World War II. And yet all these people, they all coalesced together as Eastern pilots. And that really, I mean, you know, that really amazed me. I thought it was great. I really did.
Yeah, and George, Neil, you know, our doctor for most of us, or many of us in Atlanta, Carl Ullman, he flew in the Luftwaffe also. He did, and he gave me many FAA physicals over the years. And it's sort of funny, at his retirement party, he got up, and there was a bunch of us there at the Marriott by the airport, and one of the guys in the audience, Jeff Millard, who flew P-51s after he flew the Bel Air Cobra. But he flew P-51s over Germany, and Dr. Carl Ullman's up there, you know, addressing the audience on his retirement, and he said, and up in the air, right there is a Jeff Millard, who tried his best to shoot me down, but he never found me. Of course, that brought that big laugh from the audience, you know. And Jet just grinned like a lot of shots here from Captain Culture.
Our board is completely lit up tonight, and so please, if you have a comment you want to make about World War II or anything for that matter, please do so.
Also, just something in honor of my mom and dad, everybody, if you can hear me, everybody out there, it's Ken. My mom was born in 27. She was almost 15 when that happened on December 7th, and what she remembers is somebody running down the street in Dundalk, Maryland, outside of her house, yelling, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. And everybody that was in the vicinity just looked around at each other and said, where's Pearl Harbor?
Oh, my goodness.
So that's how far removed, I think this whole thing is from there. And, you know, my other stuff, not necessarily you said or other war stories, a couple people that I got connected with taking care of seniors here in Bradenton was one gentleman named Carl Cobb. He's about 6'4", 6'5", and his wife was in the memory unit, and he was in independent living. And he would come over and visit, but he was a pilot. I didn't know that pilots were co-pilots back then, and the captains were called aircraft commanders. But he flew out of the North Mariana Field, and he flew to Tokyo at those 17-hour missions at 7,500 feet. And I thought, the only thing I could think of is how sore his butt must have got on those missions, because they were so long and the humdrum of the engines. But, yeah, he... he did a big no-no. The aircraft commander got up and left, and you're never supposed to ever sit in their seat, and he got over in his seat. Okay, that's not the half of it. He fell asleep. And the aircraft commander came up and found him. Yeah, so that's one story. Another one was a gentleman who was shot down over Germany in a flying fortress or super fortress, and I mean, they all bailed. The bombardier was killed, and the aircraft was on fire, and and he was found a couple days later by the Germans, and he was taken to a camp. But these people are fascinating to talk to them, that I would talk to them in their rooms. And then the last story, which happened to me initially about 4 years ago, wouldn't you know it, I can't remember his name, and I'm desperately looking at online here. I'm trying to look up the name of the co-pilot for the Nagasaki two guys, and I can't find it. But was a gentleman, I want to say his name was Don Cowan, don't quote me on that. But he was on board the USS Indianapolis. Yeah, and when it got hit, off he and his two bunk buddies got thrown from their bunk on the first impact. And those two took off, and they ran down the hall. He stopped to put his shoes on, and those two guys got hit by the second torpedo.
Oh,
and they were killed on impact. But, yeah, Don was in the water for all those days, and it's such a learning experience for me. As I consider myself a young lad. I'll be 55, but I'm young listening to these people tell these stories. But you guys, especially Neil and you other guys out there, and Dorothy, all of you, you are the greatest generation the world will ever know, and I take my hat off to all of you.
No, thank you.
Very kind words, Ken.
Listening to what we were reading tonight is amazing to hear the actual recordings from back when. I mean,
we, of course, were too young
and we couldn't hear it when we were small. I was only 1 year old when it started. But listening to it now was just incredible. It gave me goosebumps. It made me want to sit and cry, knowing what was coming up. It was just terrifying for me. Can you imagine what it would have been like if it was real at that time?
I have
one more little story I'm going to throw in here about this time. And right after Eastern went out of business, and I was looking around for a job, and I did find one up in Maryland. I flew for a little airline up there, and then I got a call from a friend of mine that had a headhunter company, and he asked me if I'd like to go to Honolulu and be the vice president and director of flight operations of a air cargo company called Hawaii Pacific Air. And I said, boy, that sounds great. I went out. I was living in Pensacola at the time. I went out, and I was to replace a fellow that was 77 years old. His name was Captain C.E. Fairchild.
Okay.
And we call him Clarence E. Fairchild, and we call him C.E. And so I went to Hawaii and met CE, as we call him there, at operations at Hawaii Pacific Air. And he was at Pearl Harbor during the attack. And his hangar caught fire. He was burned in both arms. And he survived Pearl Harbor. But prior to that, before the war, he was on the crew or in the crew of Admiral Thomas Mora. And Admiral Mora, of course, became eventually the chief of Joint Chiefs of Staff. He was the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Navy Admiral. But at the time, World War II, he was a lieutenant, and he was flying a PBY. And they were shot down in the Pacific by the Japanese aircraft. And one of their crew members was killed, and they pulled the PBY to the shore, and CE survived that. CE gave me a signed autograph of a book that was published while I was out there. He gave it to me, and I gave it to somebody to read, and I never got it back. It's one of those deals, but inserted in that book, I'll never forget, was the War College or the Department of War. Excuse me, Department of War asked Admiral, eventually Admiral Mora, Thomas Mora, to write a report of that incident, and he did, and it was typewritten on a typewriter. And lots of mistakes were made in that initial report, and it was inserted in that book. And I asked CE, I said, are you sure you want to give this to me? And he said, yeah. He says, that's all right. He says, yeah, take the book and what's in it. And I gave it to someone to read, and I forgot that that letter was still in there. But it was the original draft of the letter that Thomas Mora, Admiral Mora, Lieutenant Mora, presented to the Department of War about the incident of that PBY prior to World War II. But Captain Fairchild was a director that I replaced, and I enjoyed it for a short period of time because the airline ran out of money. But I did listen to a lot of war stories that CE told me over at the Officers Club, Pearl Harbor. It was a great experience meeting a man like that and listening to his account of Pearl Harbor because he was there.
Just amazing what people went through.
Yeah.
Well,
Neil, I've got one other memory.
Yeah, Jim.
I've got quite a few memories. Can I tell one more?
Sure, go ahead.
I think it's sort of important for this day and age. But one of the biggest memories I have during the war years was whenever we went to a movie, and every little town had a movie. I mean, big towns had two or three movies, but every little town like Lexington, Mississippi, or Durand, or Chula, they all had a movie theater, mom and pop type thing. But at the end of every movie, no matter where it was, Jackson, probably New York City, Chicago, everywhere, whenever the movie was over, they would have a short scene of the waving American flag. And invariably, everybody in the audience would stand up and clap and cheer. I can remember that to this day. You never went to the movie except at the end of it, you cheered and clapped because you were proud of the American flag. And I wish we could say that today.
Jim, do you suppose we'll ever have that spirit again? Do you suppose that it will have a...
I hope so. We need it bad.
We need it.
Sure do. We need some... Some people need to stop and realize where we would be if we didn't have some of the people fighting for us, all these veterans that are around that they see and don't really have a lot of respect for, unfortunately. They don't realize that none of us would be here if we didn't have someone protecting us way back when. And they certainly did that.
Well, Mr. Kapanik, that...
Well, you know, we
Neal.
Had, yes, Norma Jean, go ahead. So good to hear from you, Norma Jean.
My mother had three brothers, and all three of them were in the military, Army and two in the Navy. And the middle brother, my Uncle Lonnie, he was on the Yorktown in the Pacific when it went down.
Wow.
Oh, my golly.
And I remember when he came home, I must have been like 7 or 8.
Mm-hmm.
And when he came to, floating out in the water, I remember him saying that he had a little gold pinky ring. And he said, that's all I had on whenever they rescued him out of the Pacific. I think that was... around the Midway, Yorktown went down around the Midway, or I don't know if that was the Mariana Islands or where. And I also, just a little snapshot was, it was like, we lived next door to my aunt and uncle. And I think a lot of people, I think we did a lot of that then. You lived closer to your relatives, I think, than you do now.
Yeah.
And I remember the blackouts. And my uncle had a big radio, like, I forgot what that thing was. But anyway, it was shaped like the jukeboxes, that big round, and it was wood, wood, you know, and then they had that brown cloth-like stuff on the bottom. But I remember there were no lights. Everybody had to turn their lights out. And I remember everybody in their living room, and I remember sitting on the floor, but it didn't matter if I'm 7, you know, that's easy. Not so easy now. But, I was like 7 years old, and that was like 1942 when we had the blackouts. And routinely, we had to gather around that radio and listen for any news that they were about to impart to us. But that's about all I remember.
Norma Jean, do you remember? We did listen to the radio, and we had that little dial there. We turned right or left, and we got the frequency of the station that we knew, and we heard the reports of what was happening during World War II. Also, as a child, I remember going to the theater, and along with Hopalong Cassidy and the comedy and the main feature was Pathé News, and we got a lot of our reports of the war, things that were going on during Pathé News. On Saturdays, my mom used to give me enough money to go to the movies, get a box of popcorn, and see the movie. And
I think the movie was like 10 or 15 cents, and then milk duds were a nickel.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah,
I spent that quarter
and Coke
every Saturday.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah.
But Jim is right about that. The flag and the clap and cheering and, you know, after. And I don't know where this new nonsense coming down with the last year or two, but those people, you know, they're just they're out in la-la land. They have really no clue about what could be here, and we could have been speaking another language now, you know.
Yeah.
When did they have the green stamps? Because as a kid, I remember that. Of course, I don't know how long after the war. I don't know whether if it started in the war or, you know, during the war.
I think that was back in the 50s, Dorothy.
Okay.
Did you say the green stamps?
They were in the 60s. Eastern gave them.
No, we had those at Eastern.
Yeah. Yeah.
We had those stamps at Eastern.
But I didn't quite know when it started and what the purpose of it was.
It was a marketing idea, and I remember Captain Tom Mayberry used to always come in at the station when we landed, and he would say, "Fill them up and give me the green stamps."
Yeah, Uncle Tom.
Uncle Tom.
And one more note. The other day I found a transistor radio that I listened to when Hurricane Cleo, I think it was, in Miami. Cleo or Betsy. And, of course, it doesn't work anymore. But, anyway, I found that thing in a box. I was going through a bunch of stuff I need to get rid of.
Wow.
Anyway, they don't know what transistor radios were.
Boy, they were big when they came out. Everybody had to have one. Little bitty thing, pick up radio on AM. Oh, man, that was the greatest thing.
Oh, it's about,
thing.
What, 3 inches by 4? Yeah, it's
mm-hmm.
real.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They
were still
kept
in the box. Mm. Yeah, one was Emerson, and I forgot what the other one was.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway,
well,
that's all I remember.
You know, when I looked up and did a little research about the great announcers back during World War II, the names that we read off, I forgot who read those off, but Kelton Bourne and Gabriel Heater and Walter Winchell, of course. It was fun. These were the stars back in those days. They had name recognition, and I guess they have them today. The same thing. They seem to replace them now more frequently because of is coming
and more
coming
so.
Up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're going to have a bunch of new ones pretty soon, I think.
Yeah, there's a whole new crop coming up.
And, you know, back in those days, we believed those people, and they were telling the truth for the most part.
Yeah.
I mean, they certainly weren't trying to lie to us, but they sometimes got things wrong. But who knows who believes what these people say anymore, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, but
Walter
the people,
Cronkite.
If they made a mistake, I think it was honest. It wasn't contrived.
Yeah.
Yes, that's correct. That's correct.
That's right. That's right, Norma Jean. Walter Cronkite, go ahead, Jim. I mean, Chuck, go ahead.
That's because today they got fake news. They don't have real news. And that's what they put out there. They think that everybody in this country is so gullible and so stupid that they're going to believe it. And guess what? There's people out there that decide, just like you did. You dug up trying to get names for these people that you wanted on the program tonight. And there's people out there that dig up these newscasts and find out that these people are lying to us. And that's where the fake news came in from. And you're right. We don't have those type of people, at least I don't think so, that you can really believe in their word. You know, their word was bond.
Yeah.
Well, their mama raised
you
right.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Absolutely.
These people all are clueless. Some
getting headlines and bottom line. That's all it is.
Us in Japan defeated Australia in World War II. They have no idea what happened in World War II.
Yeah. Well, a lot of the youth today think Utah is overseas somewhere. Yeah, they have no idea what history and geography is all about. They have no clue. It's
no, they don't know where anything is.
I know it. It's just amazing. Yeah, it was the greatest generation, and I'm glad that I was part of it, just a little bit of it. I caught it at the end, but I'm proud to say I was there, as most of you hosts and listeners were back in the day. And it was a great time to have lived and be part of that history.
And we knew the difference anyway with then and now.
Yeah.
I'm glad we could at least share a little bit about that tonight for those listeners out there. I sure appreciated it, so thank you, Neil.
We wanted to do this show because December 7th is just a couple of days away, 3 days away, and December 4th. But it was quite a history of this country. And as Walter Winchell, when he did that report, December 6th, you recall December 6th, December 7th, excuse me, he did that report that I had on a sound clip tonight. He did that clip. And right at the end, he felt the need to ask all people listening to go to their recruiting office and sign up, because he knew that this country was about to start our efforts in World War II, which, just like Franklin Delano Roosevelt said, we will prevail, and we did.
A lot of women signed up, too.
Right.
If you recall, I had an aunt that was she was a welder in New London, Connecticut, working on submarines.
Wow.
Mm. Mm.
Isn't that something?
What was it,
about?
Betsy the Riveter? Betsy the Riveter,
yeah,
or something like that?
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
She was a welder.
Maybe I ought to do a show on the ladies' efforts in World War II. We are hoping to get the lady that is in the 90s. She's in her 90s now. To be on our show. I'll be going down to Sebring in January, and hopefully I can recruit her to be on our radio show, because she was a WASP during World War II, and she's 90-some years old now. So we're hoping to be able to get her on the radio show, Dorothy.
Okay, we'll keep trying.
You did an awful lot of work for tonight's show. You did a lot of digging, and it took many hours.
Yeah.
Great
job, Neil.
Yes,
excellent.
You did.
Well, it's there. You know, I'm learning now. I don't have to be creative at all. There's no sense of reinventing the wheel, creating something, because it's already been created on the internet, and you can find anything, just about anything you want to find on the internet, and just do a little digging.
You had the real thing. You had the voices.
Yeah.
That's amazing to have that.
You took a lot of time digging that out.
Right.
Well,
he doesn't but tonight's no different.
Don? Mm-hmm. Well, that's about all the sounds that I hear right now. So, Dorothy, do you have anything else to add about what's coming up and our future shows?
Yes, I just want a couple of reminders. Don't forget to go to the REPA website for updates on the scheduled convention at the Francis Marion Hotel in Charleston, South Carolina. That's going to be September
7th. Good convention. Good convention. Y'all come.
Absolutely.
We will be there, Jim Holder.
Mighty fine. Mighty fine.
The Silver Liners Convention. That's coming 15th to the 18th, and they too have their website to go to and get some more information on that. And on our website, don't forget to, if you need some holiday gifts and looking into good reading, we have some hosts that have written some excellent books, and they're also on our website.
Absolutely.
So please go to the book review and take a look at that. And I added a couple of new things from the past. And Ken, thank you so much for sending us that photo ID of your dad with Eastern. So it's on from the past. And please take a look at that tab, and you'll bring back a little bit of reminders.
And
you're
welcome.
About, this week on that, but I would like to mention that next week's show, December 11th, is going to be Eastern and Air Force One, and Neil will have a great script on that. I'm absolutely sure of it. And then the following week, we're going to talk about open mic. Let's talk Eastern, and we'd like to talk to our own Eastern people about their feelings on the recent announcement of the Eastern Airlines Group and the canceling of their .AOC. We'd like to hear what you have to think about, what you say about it, and your feelings, just like we'd like to share you ours. There's breaking news on the website that we announced tonight, so be sure to go there and review the last portion of what we couldn't read to you. And that's about it, Neil, for tonight, so back to you.
Well, Dorothy, you've done a great job putting that website together, and we've got albums. So it's just so much there that a person can just meander around the website and see pictures of photo albums of different folks that have put their pictures, and I've got mine on there, and you might want to just kind of look through what is posted there, because we do have photo albums available, and you can put your own pictures in that photo albums. It's a feature that will allow our listeners and members to their own albums, create their own albums and put them in there. Of course, we're hoping that they are all about Eastern Airlines or friends that they know with Eastern. Great show tonight. It really was. And a lot of the information that I find is on Facebook. For instance, this past week, a lot of Facebook postings was about training. All the different departments sent those new hires to Miami to be trained with Eastern Airlines. And a lot of them stayed at the villas. And I told Dorothy, I said, you know, all the stuff that I'm looking at on Facebook now about all these, especially flight attendants and reservationists and different departments of Eastern, they stayed at the villas. They did their training there. And I think they even used the swimming pool there to do the flight attendants ditching and survival or whatever. And I think that'd be a great show that we would do this coming year. So we're going to try to put that in there. Your memories about staying at the villas and your training when you were first hired with Eastern Airlines. We think that would be an interesting topic to talk about on the radio show. We're going to do
cool.
it. Okay.
Yeah. Hey, can I say one more thing? I just wanted to interject. It's just killing me,
go
guys.
Ahead.
Thanks. And I'll be honest with you, Neil, I've been wanting to say this for several shows now, and I know we always run out of time. If everybody cares to join me, you know what? Neil, I just got to take my hat off to you. I think you do a hell of a job on the show. You really do. You put in a lot of time, and I think you're a terrific host. And I'm going to give him a round of applause. How about it, guys?
I agree.
Hey,
yeah.
Hey, listen, I got the sound effects for applause, and it sounds like this, Ken.
Okay.
Oh,
my. Yeah. Nick off.
Yeah.
Was that the voice board that was lit up? Was that doing
yeah.
that? Well, every night, Neil, you got to do that. Yet. Every Monday night, you got to do that, please, for yourself. Yeah. And we'll all join in.
Oh, golly. Yeah, oh, it was a great show tonight. I enjoyed it. It was great landing, Captain Steve. We don't have time to hear the aircraft landing and touching down on the runway, but Captain Steve, you did a great job putting the airplane on the ground again. Be sure to tune in again next Monday at 7 p.m. when Eastern Flight 345 will be departing from the gate with another great adventure. That's our show for tonight, and we thank all of our participating folks in tonight's broadcast. Thank you so much. Don't forget, fly your flag December 7th. Fly your flag in front of your house. We do. Our neighborhood does. Our community does, and it's a great, great sight to see. With this, we take a line from Lake Wobegon, where all the Eastern women are unequaled, all the Eastern men are good-looking, and all the Eastern children and Eastern grandchildren are above average. And until then, we say, every one of us. Good night, Eastern family. We love you, Eastern.
Good night, Eastern family.
Love you guys.
We love you, Eastern.
Good night. Love you, Eastern.
Love you.